Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Happy heresies and welcome to the Desert of the Real. My name is Miguel Connor and I am still your Pompidus of Gnosis. How about a special show, a presentation from the Finding Hermes group? As many of you know, the Finding Hermes group is a sort of upgrade from AB Prime or Patreon, where we have exclusive and private meetings twice a month. One of them is a Q&A and discussion, and the other one is also exclusive presentation. This presentation that I'm making public is from Alex Rivera on his new book, The Laurel Turns Green. If you don't know Alex's work, he's an amazing researcher when it comes to Gnosticism. An incredible eye. In fact, the book he co-wrote with Tracy Twyman, rest her soul, the book Baphomet is one of my favorite books of all times, especially when it comes to research on, yes, Baphy himself, Abraxas, Sophia, the origins of Gnosticism, and the Knights Templar, an excellent book. And his new book, The Laurel Turns Green, is really up there too. So get ready for Alex's research on some enigmatic gods like Eros, Hermes, Mithra, Saturn, and how these beings tie into esoteric groups like the Cult of Orpheus, Gnostic sects, Thelema, Kabbalah, Freemasonry, and yes, the Knights Templar. He puts it all together and gives us a historical overview of these powers that have been influencing humanity for thousands of years. Great presentation that I wanted to make public for you. So please, if you can, join the Finding Hermes group. When I do a presentation on, let's say, Gnosticism and something related, I often put it in the virtual Alexandria Academy, and you can have access to that with just a one-time payment. But there are presentations that never make it to the light of day that are just for the group. Very exclusive. Some of these include deeper dives into Carl Jung and Mary Magdalene, presentations on Gnostic and also mystic meditations, presentations on how to avoid mind control, and so forth. I've even done a presentation where I talked about my experiences with ayahuasca. It's very personal. And I tie in Amazon groups like Santo Daime and others to Gnostic thought. So check it out because it's very rewarding and it's a deeper dive into Gnostic thought, philosophy, and theology. I even recently did a presentation with some guests on A Course in Miracles, where we talk about its Gnostic ideas and how it can make it work for you. And, well, it's very cool. Check that out, too. For all non-subs, you will just get Alex's electric presentation. For all subs like Patreons, AB Prime members, Red Circle subscribers, and Cats on Rockfin, I will also include our Q&A afterwards. And it's very intense as we talk a lot about the Demiurge and Gnosis and other things. So once again, for the full dope, please join one of the membership levels or just join the Finding Hermes program. And for those of you watching the Q&A, you'll notice I'm on my phone. That day when we did the presentation with Alex, There was a huge ice storm here where I live, and all power was out. I had to get on my phone, but I was able to get online, get everybody together and record it, and it all worked out really well. So in case you're wondering why I'm just wandering around with my phone in the dark, that's the reason. But enough of my drivel, as I used to say. Let's get to the presentation. I think you'll really enjoy it. As always, write your own gospel, live your own myth.
So my name is Alex Rivera. So I am the author of a few different books here. I wrote a book called The Suddenly Unveiled back in 2020. And this is this book is basically a collection of different essays I wrote on my website. It's called theaoneye.com. And the book, now it's really named after a group of Cathars, right? Well, a Cathar prophecy. Now, the book itself is not so much about the Cathars, but it kind of sort of took the term The Laurel Turns Green from a Cathar priest called Gilham Ballybast, something like that. Yeah. And he was a Cathar priest, and he was burned at the stake in 1321 by the Catholic Inquisition. And what had happened is before his sudden execution by the fiery flames, he uttered a prophecy that the Laurel will turn green again in 700 years. Okay. And when we add up the numbers, 700 years from 1321, it adds up to 2021, right? Now, when I wrote an article called Cathar Prophecies, Lion Gate in the Age of Wormwood. And that whole thing was about how this Cathar prophecy ties into a lot of these other concepts I've noticed, such as, you know, when we talk about Aleister Crowley's Aeon of Horus, or also like the Age of Wormwood, the Age of Aquarius, all that good stuff. So all these different ages are kind of sort of coalescing. And then when I looked at that, then we see what's happening now on the world stage. You know, everything is just kind of going a little crazy here. So I thought maybe it kind of maybe means something significant. So that's where I got that the term "the laurel turns green" from, that Cathar prophet, or sorry, martyr, I should say. So who exactly were the Cathars? Well, this is just a blurb here, real quick. So kind of like what I said earlier. So, I mean, now the book itself, I mean, it is a conjunction of different ideas and philosophies that I've kind of researched over the years, from like the Orphic Mysteries, Hermetic philosophers, the Corpus Hermeticum, Neoplatonism, that I also get into the histories of like Jesus Christ, Simon the Magician, Apollonius, Iamblichus, stuff like that. I also get into, also in the book, the hidden mysteries of the Promethean Lucifer Lightbearer archetype, right, that we see a lot, you know, in the occult, and then also get into the Kabbalistic ritual program that we've seen in the movie Mother. So that's a really interesting movie. And I actually wrote an essay for Miguel's website, so by the way, it's all about that. Pretty crazy. Once you we can dedicate like a whole show to that. So here we go. Cathar prophecy. So kind of like said earlier. So we have this coalescence or conjunction of different prophecies, occult prophecies, happening really at the same time. Really, I think. And then towards the end here, I mean, you kind of get the gist of what I said earlier. So, but it says here 2023 is the inverse of 322, and it's also the year of the rabbit according to the Chinese zodiac. So the 322 is associated with the Skull and Bones Society at Yale University. So coincidentally, Yale turns 322 years old this year. Now, who exactly were the Cathars? So the Cathars were a medieval Gnostic Christian sect, And they were in southern France, and they were around, you know, the 12th century. But of course, they were stamped out by the Roman Catholic Church. Now, the thing with the Roman Catholic Church was, if you were a heretic around that time, you were basically an enemy of the state, basically. So if you exhibited any sort of heresy, I mean, you were kind of looked at with suspicion. So that this whole Inquisition thing was what jump-started the witch hunts of the later Middle Ages, right? Now, the Cathars, they tend to live in chastity and poverty without possessions. They didn't like wealth, unlike the Roman Catholic Church, right, at the time. And of course, they still are. Now, they're also known as Albigensians from the town of Albi. And of course, when we looked at Cathar beliefs, they have this very radically dualist idea that we also can be traced to the Manichaeans. And the Manichaeans, I mean, they themselves believed in the two principles, both light and darkness. And of course, that comes from Zoroastrianism as well. But when you look at a lot of these Cathar beliefs, especially look at the Book of Two Principles is one. Another one's called the Secret Supper is another one. So they basically believe that humanity were just basically fallen angels, right? So basically, the story goes that humanity were Adam and Eve were originally angels in heaven, but they were tricked by Lucifer or the Rex Mundi in heaven. And then we fell from heaven, from the Pleroma, if you want to call it that. But then we became trapped in corrupt matter, in these cycles of reincarnation. So, and to be released from this cycle of dukkha, as the Buddhists call it, it's through the purification ritual known as the consolamentum. Okay, and the consolamentum was it's almost like how popes or they channel the Holy Spirit into the next pope or whoever, right? So you're basically like a spirit, like a game of spiritual game tag. So you're it, right? So, and then all of that. So all that spiritual energy is charged, and then you take on that blessing, and then that's what sort of like makes you initiate into the Cathar faith, right? So of course, the purpose of life was to renounce all pleasures of the flesh, enticements of the world through vegetarianism, celibacy. So through repeated incarnations, one can make it back to heaven. And of course, all material things were produced by the Demiurge or the Rex Mundi. And all spiritual things were produced by the good God of the New Testament. And of course, I mentioned it earlier, there were Manichaeans, or much like the Manichaeans, believed like them. Now, if you look at the Orphic religion, so I get into this essay that I wrote. It's called The Orphic Eros and On the Origin of the World. And how that worked, well, how what they believed is basically is that, of course, they're obviously pagan because they believed in a different Orphic deities, like Phanes is one, Mithras is another one, and all connects to this deity called Eros as well, that you see in Greek philosophy. Now, they also created things like the Orphic hymns. And some of their beliefs included that human souls are divine and immortal, and they're doomed to live in this grievous cycle of successive bodily lives through this transmigration of the souls. And they also practice secret initiation rites to connect their souls to the better afterlife. Okay. Now, there's a text, a Gnostic text in the Nag Hammadi. It's called On the Origin of the World. And how that, it's like a really crazy text. So it opens up, it's like a mixture of different ideas. You see that from Genesis, you see that from You see a lot of influences from Hesiod's Theogony is another one. A lot of influences from the Kabbalah as well. Well, I mean, not the Kabbalah that we, you know, consider Kabbalah today, but I mean, there's a lot of correspondences for sure. So basically, text opens up as a philosophical discourse about primeval chaos, along with the establishment of the boundary between the upper and the lower worlds, the formation of Yaldabaoth, the chief ruler generated by Pistis Sophia. So the cosmogony and later the anthropogony are partially oriented to the earthly chapters of Genesis, as well as Jubilees and One Enoch. Then, now, of course, there are Jewish influences that also surface in the author's angelology, demonology, eschatology, and even epistemologies. So then it says here, so the central teaching of the text is that of the immortal light Adam. So, and I'm sure the Cathars believed a lot of this stuff. This all connects to how the Adam Kadmon is a very Kabbalistic idea. So it says here, from borrowing from Genesis 1:26 and 2:7, humanity is said to be created by the archons or rulers, according to the image of the bestial archons and the likeness of the light Adam. So a heavenly primeval man who corresponds in a certain way to the third messenger in Manichaeism. And of course, the Adam Kadmon, the Kabbalah, and the Anthropos of Poemandry that we see in the Hermetic literature. Now it says here in a counter campaign in the light world, the Sophia or Zoe, who functions as a savior and also competes or completes the Archon's unfinished creation of man, fashions a spiritual man who is manifested in different ways as a bringer of the Gnosis, as the spiritual wife of Adam, as the serpent or the beast, and as the instructor in paradise who is viewed favorably. So fundamentally, all of these beings are Sophia, or Zoe herself. So, I mean, they kind of read like different aspects of her, really. Now, Eros is singled out as with the atom of light in the text is portrayed as providing the creative seed that generated the cycles of birth and death. So Eros is also credited to providing the creative seed for plants and animals on the earth through the help of the angels and their seed. And it says here, originally Eros is portrayed as the youngest of all the gods as a deity of love and Platonic thought. Now, Eros is first mentioned in the Symposium of by Plato through the wise priestess or oracle Diotima. Now, Eros is really interesting because he's a very multifaceted spirit, if you want to call it that. So Eros is, according to one of a sentence by Ignatius of Antioch, where he says it's a connection to Romans 7:2 as an appellation of Christ, and is also the name conferred by this Gnostic sect on the primal man in his brightest manifestation. Now, here's a little quote from On the Origin of the World. And when I say Gnostic sect, I mean, it could very well, I mean, just no one really knows who wrote this book or this text. A lot of it might be a single author, might be multiple authors. I mean, it kind of feels like it belongs to multiple authors. It's been worked over, I think. Kind of like the New Testament, I would say. So here, let me read this. So it says, out of the first blood, Eros appeared, being androgynous. His masculine nature is Hemeros. So there's Eros, right? Because he is fire from light. His feminine nature, which is with him, is a blood soul and is derived from the substance of proanoia. So he is very handsome in his beauty, having more loveliness than all the creatures of chaos. Then when all the gods and their angels saw Eros, they became enamored of him. Okay. And it says Eros is the son of the proanoia, which is the form of anoia or forethought, a form or mask of Barbello. So, well, I was doing a little digging into that And so it's like a divine cosmology that we see in a lot of these Gnostic texts. So it's sort of like a reference to that. Then it says here, chaos is here, the matrix of creation, as it is in the Gnostic sermon of Hippolytus. So Eros resembles the primal man in this combination of sexes, hermaphroditic, and those who see him feel the same desire that is awakened by Epaminondas, that other emanation of the divine mind. So Eros is ultimately a luminous or androgynous or even enthalpic or eternally hard or rex symbol of the mystery religions as a primal man. So, I mean, you see a lot of like, you know, pagan deities with a heart on, basically. Like Priapus is one, but all, you know, reference to the divine fertility, right? Then it says, Eros is also connected to Attis, Hermes, Osiris, Sophia, and even Jesus Christ himself. Eros is credited with the universal fertility, generation, the power of alchemy to transform the philosophers via its aspect of love. Now, to the Gnostics, Eros was allowed to be a take for a symbol of the Christian Redeemer and Savior, and the lover and beloved of the light of the elect. Now, of course, there are Platonic influences going on with Eros as well. So just cover a little bit here. So love is somewhere in between the beautiful and the ugly, according to Plato. So following Diotima, Socrates compares love to correct belief, that is, between ignorance and knowledge. Now, what's also interesting about love or Eros is that he's called a daemon or the great daemon. So, and daemons were considered that, I'm sorry, the gods were considered to be like daemons, according to Homer. Now, love is between the mortal and immortal. So we see that in Symposium. The myth of the birth of love. So he was a son born on Aphrodite's birthday of the parents, which Eros is kind of like this weird, interesting mix of like resource and need. So it's like, so love is described as hard, harsh, and barefoot, not soft and delicate. So that's one aspect of Eros. Okay, and now Eros is also interestingly called a magician by Plato. So this matches the idea that the Greek philosophers were often confused as magicians, much like prophets, priests, kings, and messiahs. And they're also often confused or connect to the magician, basically. Now, the esoteric practice of theurgy was devised to transform the soul into an immortal divine substance. So this is all comparable to how Eros, the intermediary daemon, is referred to as a magician by Plato. So here's an interesting quote from Plato. It says, his father sighed, for its part makes him a schemer after the beautiful and good, courageous and pietous and intense, a clever hunter, always weaving new devices, both passionate for wisdom and resourceful in looking for it, philosophizing through all his life, a clever magician, sorcerer, and sophist. You see that from the Symposium. And then there are other Orphic influences going on in that text on the origin of the world. So there's a Greek god by the name of Hephaestus. He was considered a Greek god of fire, metallurgy, and building construction. So if you kind of think about it, he's sort of like a symbol of the demiurge. So he's a god of construction, right? So he's a son of Zeus and Hera, although later it's debated. So he is often identified with the Italian volcanic god Andronis, Vulcanus, Tubal-Cain of Genesis, and Azazel of 1 Enoch. Then it says Hephaestus was also has a minor role in Orphic literature. He was the forger of the mirror that distracted Dionysus while the infernal Titans plotted to rend them limb from limb. Zeus got this revenge against the Titans by hurling bolts of lightning to destroy them. It is said that out of their ashes, humanity was forged from their blood as the elements of Dionysus. So Platonist, to whom the sensible universe was a mirror of Dionysus, and would understand the world's soul being dismembered by its fall into this mirror that is the cosmos. So it lived a fragmentary existence in the souls of individuals. So seduced, now it was seduced like the Anthropos of the Meritica, the soul becomes a prisoner of the world. So you see that in the Hermetica pretty explicitly. So I know in the Hermetica it talks about how that the rational soul is basically, or the Anthropos is seduced by nature, and then he sort of like falls in love with his image in the water. So it's kind of like where you get the term narcissist from, right? And now here's an excerpt from an essay I wrote for Miguel's website called Johnny Mercury, John the Baptist in Egypt. And I just thought it was pretty interesting what I kind of put together. So now Jesus is also called the Word of Logos of God. I mean, I don't have to read the whole thing if you guys don't want me to, but if you want, I mean, whatever. But he's called the Reason of God. The Logos translates to reason. Now there's also the Logi, which are sort of like a plural version of Logos, but I thought it was really interesting. So Logi are also referred to the Platonic forms related to the God. So theoretical tokens and symbols are used by the Platonists, like or Neoplatonists like Iamblichus, which I get into the book. I know I wrote an essay called Theurgy and the Chaldean Oracles. So I get into Iamblichus pretty heavily in that essay. But he actually believed, like, he called it demiurgy, but you're not really fighting against the demiurge, really. You're just more like you're working with the demiurge to become a demiurge, the theurgy. It's kind of interesting how what he believed. That it says here, Hermes' influences also extends to the celestial beings known as angels. And in the essay, I also connect Hermes and Mercury with Eros as well. So there's a connection there, because they're both considered messenger deities or intermediaries. And then, so think about how the Mercury and Hermes is both messenger of the gods. The angel means messenger in Greek. The role in the cosmic order is mercurial in function, so they all connect to Mercury in some way. Angels, that is. And then Hermes or Mercury is the green man, also known as the horn god or Cernunnos. And of course, these symbols may exist in the forms of like a lion, a rooster, a heliotrope, or all representations of Helios and Apollon. This is interesting. So Iamblichus, he interprets different Greek and Hermetic gods like Asclepius, Dionysus as different manifestations of the demiurge or sublunar demiurge. So I haven't really seen other texts get into that. I know, of course, you know, we see Gnostic texts divide the demiurge into several different powers. But the way he does is a little more specialized to his purposes, because he's more of a pagan, of course. So he wasn't really into the Christian stuff, right? Now, Iamblichus, he was a Neoplatonic philosopher in the 4th century. So he wrote different books, like on the Egyptian Mysteries is one. And I know he's very much into that Hermetic Pythagorean current, if you want to call it that. And let's see here. So we have different gods, like, yeah, of course, Cronos, then you have Asclepius and Dionysus. They're all different aspects of the demiurge. is how he'd interpret it. So then it says here, the initiated theurgus was said to have the logi filled in their souls and magical rituals dedicated to Mercury, such as a consecration of the talisman, the logi, or the element of that deity is said to empower the object, much like how the Catholic priest is said to bless holy water of the Eucharist through the laying of hands via the Holy Spirit power. So you can think of the logi as the intellectual forms. So it's all very magical. So let's pull it that way. But it does connect to Neoplatonic theurgy.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
So let's talk a little bit more about Eros. So Eros connects with the myth of the Orphic egg, surrounded by the cosmic snake or Ouroboros from the Orphic mystery schools, which went back to Greece in the 5th century. They taught that Eros was the same as a figure called Phanes. This is basically the creator of the universal egg, called Nyx as well. So different aspects to this deity. So I think it was Nyx. Nyx is basically the primeval chaos that gives birth to existence. So basically it forms all the gods are birthed from the primeval chaos, basically, in Greek mythology. Now we see depictions of Phanes with his body surrounded by a serpent, strongly resembles the images of the Leontocephaline, the lion-headed version of Mithras. As Saturn, also shown as wrapped in a snake that were found in many Mithraeums. So you see other related symbols, including the one snake rod of Asclepius and the double snake rod of Hermes, the Caduceus. So here we have is some images of, so we have Mithras in the middle, and then you have Phanes on the right, and then on the left you have Ion. So they're all basically different aspects of the same deity, really. So then, you know, what's kind of think about what's crazy, like what's happening with like in when you see like a lot of these YouTube channels, they talk about these egg rituals, and you see all these eggs somehow manifesting. There's always issues with eggs going on. So I just thought it's kind of interesting synchronicity that right there. So we have the Orphic egg surrounded by the serpent, right? So, and this all connects to alchemy for sure. So in the middle, you have on the right, of course, there's the Orphic egg, and then in the center and the left, of course, the Ouroboros. And these are all symbols of something called in the Hermetica, it's called the One Thing, which is like this, the primeval monad. It's like sort of like the source of all existence, you know, or the potentials, right? Then you have, here's an image of Hermes Trismegistus I found that's in the book. And I think that's a wood carving. And let's see here. Now here's the demiurge, or one aspect of the demiurge, really. I mean, it just seems like to me, all these philosophers, they had to believe in demiurge. I mean, if you weren't part of the, I mean, if you were any good Platonist would believe in the demiurge. So all these different gods are like aspects of that, or representations of the demiurge, if you ask any good Platonist, right? Or Neoplatonist. And then over here, this is from my book, or images I found really online, but I added in the book. So you have Abraxas on the left, and on the right you have the lion-headed Abraxas. Kind of seems like they're I mean, there's multiple practices going on. So I thought that was interesting. So, and I talk about that in the Amplicus essay. Now, this is an Ophite Gnostic map of the universe. And if you look at the top, it says here, the sphere of Sophia, the soul of the world. It kind of looks an egg, right? And then below that is Gehenna or Tartarus. So, and then Leviathan, a behemoth, basically are said to surround our world. This is what a lot of these Gnostics believe, right? The dragon eternally surrounds our universe, or our world, if you want to call it that. But then there are, of course, the seven planetary powers. So there's Eloi, Sabaoth, Yaldabaoth is mentioned here, Adonai. Then, of course, below that, and you see the different angels like Michael, Raphael, Gabriel, Suriel. Then here's another Gnostic Ophite map that I found. And, you know, it's all very Kabbalistic. So it's sort of like, I mean, of course, obviously the Ophites didn't actually wrote this, but devised this, but sort of like an image representation of what we see written by Celsus. So he wrote a book called True History. So he was a Platonic historian. And he was quoted by another, or a Christian apologist by the name of Origen. But he was trying to say, you know, this is all nonsense. You know, he's trying to refute Celsus, because Celsus was on a rampage of refuting Christianity. So, because back then, you know, around Celsus' time, Christianity was basically a fringe alien sect, right? But what's interesting in that essay is that the Ophites and the Christians were sort of like viewed as the same. So this this division between heresy and orthodoxy wasn't as fine-tuned back then, right? As we look, so when you look towards Origen's time, that became more sanitized, you know, Christianity, that is. So you have the Father, Son, Holy Spirit. Then you have the gates of paradise. Then there's the flaming sword that protects from the lower archons. Here's another image of this Ophite map. And let's see here. Here's another one. I think this is my favorite, actually. So. I think it's just much more cleaner image, really. That it's a pretty good representation of the Ophite map. So you have Leviathan, you have the different planetary energies that sort of like, basically these are archonic heavens that are stacked on top of each other, sort of like Russian dolls. So you have them, and then beneath them is Behemoth, the Earth, and Tartarus. And of course, above all that is Leviathan. And then beyond Leviathan, of course, is the fixed stars, looks like. And then there's paradise. And then beyond that, of course, is the Pleroma, the father of all. Now, we sort of see like a reflection of that by the Tree of Fire. But, and this is sort of like a diagram that was devised by, I'm sure, by people who looked at the cosmology of Simon the Magician. So he wrote a book called, well, at least a Simonian author. We're not really sure if Simon actually wrote it, but he wrote a book called The Great Declaration, or The Great Announcement. And so I talk about that pretty in depth in the book, The Tree of Fire. So you have these different principles. So, of course, a universal principle that sort of, I think, So like this, it looks like there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 7, 8. So just basically different aeons that connect here with, of course, like there's the perfect universal principle, the five, the incomprehensible silence, supreme treasury house. Then you have the region of the types and seals. You have the middle distance and the invisible sphere. And then beneath that are the angels and in humanity, basically, the lower regions, or the sublunar regions, right? But it sort of just, to me, just looks very Kabbalistic, really. So, in my opinion, it's sort of like a much earlier variant of the Kabbalistic Tree of Life, really. Because if you think about it, Simon was initiated in Egypt along with John the Baptist. And if you look, read the Clementines, says that Simon was the son of John the Baptist, or like his follower at the very least. So he could very well have known of Jesus at that time as well. So they're all contemporaries at the very least. All this looks very similar to what we saw earlier, right? You have the Kabbalistic Tree of Life. And then on the right, you see the different angels that connect, that rule over these different spheres or filters that filter out the divine emanation of Kether throughout the universe. So this is basically a map of the universe. So it's an astral structure, interdimensional structure, I should say, that was put in place before time itself. So it's basically how God manifested not just the world, but the Pleroma, really. Sort of like a map of that. Now, of course, in Kabbalah, I mean, that's like the backbone of all ritual magic systems of the West, you know? So, I mean, of course, this is a book by Ted Hinn, so he gets into all that with path working. It's pretty interesting. Of course, it all connects to like the tarot as well. So the tarot, it can also be placed on the Tree of Life. So, I mean, they're all connected for sure. The Hermetic Tree of Life, that is. So here's a really interesting quote that I got from the Holy Kabbalah. I mean, I know I'm kind of like mixing little different things, but it all connects, in my opinion. So it says here, Bria, it says here that from A.E. Waite, he wrote a book called the Holy Kabbalah. But it says here, Bria is that of creation, so-called, that is, of the emanation of creative forces. These forces are the Elohim, and Bria is therefore the Elohistic world. So in other words, it is that of the lesser or secondary gods. It is also called the world of archangels. It would not be exact to say that the archangels are Elohim, much less that Michael, Raphael, Gabriel, and Metatron, and so forth, are deities according to the Kabbalah. So here's another image of the Kabbalistic Tree of Life from The Moonchild of Yesod by Carl Stone. Really interesting occult book. You can get a hold of that one. Of course, there's the different tarot attributions that we see as well to connect with the different pathways, to connect with the different sephiroths on the Tree of Life. And of course, above that is, you know, Ein Sof, Ein Sofer, Ein Sof, and Ein. The three negative veils of the Godhead before manifestation, or the primal nothingness, or the silence, ineffable silence that a lot of Gnostic sects call God, or the ultimate God, or the divinity behind God, really, you want to call it that. But then here's another representation, the Tree of Life, the continuation of that. Then, of course, Hod is very mercurial, for sure. So all connects to what we looked at earlier. Okay. Now, this is something that I found here. So, or a quote from D.N. Fortune. So, but before that, we get to that, it says, occult knowledge is hidden because it cannot be spoken. So the gnosis is awakening to your higher intellect, or the nous. So, which is governed by Hod on the Tree of Life, on the Pillar of Severity. So you want your intellect to be severe because it purifies our minds of every concept that is not true or false. Okay. Now, Deanne Fortune's, here's what she says. So Deanne Fortune's really good if you don't, if you haven't heard of her. She heard a lot of different books, but The Mystical Ball is a very popular book. Another one's called Psychic Self-Defense is one. A Sane Occultism is another one. So yeah, she's really a good resource if you're not familiar with Kabbalah. So if you're not familiar with Kabbalah, start with her for sure. But of course, there are other books that we can look at as well. So another one that I recommend is called, A Practical Guide to Kabbalistic Symbolism. It's by Gareth Knight. So I have it right here if you guys see it. That was really good. And of course, here's the Unfortunate book as well. But anyway, let me just read it real quick. So it says, the spiritual experience assigned to the Sephira is the vision of splendor, which is the realization of the glory of God manifesting in the created world. The initiate of Hod sees behind the appearance of created things and discerns their creator. And in the realization of the splendor of nature as the garment of the ineffable, he receives his illumination and becomes a co-worker with the great artificer. It is this realization of the spiritual forces manipulating all the manifestations and appearances, which is the key to the powers of Hod as wielded in the magic of light. It is by making himself a channel for these forces that the master of white magic brings order into the disorder of the spheres of unbalanced force. Not by deflecting the invisible powers to his personal will, he is the equilibrator of the unbalanced, not the arbitrary manipulator of nature. So what she's saying is that the initiative Hod, the magician, or the spirit, whatever you want to call him, he makes himself into the middle pillar, essentially. So your job as a magician is become balanced between the pillars of severity and mercy, right? The negative and the white pillar, or the positive pillar, or the feminine pillar. Let's see. And then it says here, he works with a great artificer. So that's interesting. So, I mean, what did we see from Iamblichus earlier? That he talks about demiurgy. So, so for them, you kind of want to work with the demiurge, or at least, or even become the demiurge, basically, is what they're basically trying to teach in their initiations. Now, here's an interesting quote from Crowley. No, I mean, I'm not the biggest fan of him, but I did find a really interesting quote from 777, the other Kabbalistic writings. So it says, a Chokmah is the logos, the messenger, the transmitter of the influence from Kether, and this is shown in a lower mode in the Sephira Hod. So it's almost like the lower Sephirots are like, yeah, they're basically channeling the greater light of these higher Sephirots, basically. So it's kind of like a fountain, kind of like the movie The Fountain, right? From Darren Aronofsky. Let's see. Then we have an image of the hermit, or images of the hermit, and that connects to Hod. So Hod, or Yod, is associated with the hermit archetype and represents conscious intentional separation from distraction while going deep into the self or the unconscious mind to bring a better fortune, higher level of truth, and expansion of the true self. Now, in the book itself, The Laurel Turns Green, so that has an image of Uriel. And he's not the most popular archangel, but he is a very important one. But on the cover, if you guys remember, if I have it right here, you have Uriel, you know, holding a sun, and then with this laurel crown or crown made of laurel leaves, right? But this, now these images just for me just remind me of a hermit, and I think, or an oriole, is basically also connects to Hode for sure. Although, I mean, Raphael is also, you know, obviously very mercurial as well. In fact, you know, he's like the Christian version of Mercury, really. Now, then I want to get into the lost jewel, and it connects to the laurel. So when Lucifer fell from heaven into the abyss, a jewel fell from his crown in his battle in heaven. So you see that in Revelation 12 with St. Michael. So the emerald is also associated with the planet Venus. Now, it was the emerald, the jewel regarded by alchemists as the stone of Mercury, otherwise known as the Emerald Tablets. Much like Eros, Mercury is a link between heaven and earth. In the biblical version, vision of St. John, it says, "And he that sat was to look upon like a jasper and a sardine stone. And there was a rainbow round about the throne in sight like unto an emerald." See that in Revelation 4:3. "The rainbow is the popular symbol of a bridge between worlds like the Norse Bifrost. According to the Grail myths, from this jewel, the angels carved the Holy Grail. When it was filled with the blood of Christ, the gates of heaven opened again." Then it says, let's see here. Now, hence why the Emerald Tablet says that in truth, without deceit, certain and most veritable, that which is below corresponds to that which is above, and that which is above corresponds to that which is below to accomplish the miracles of the one thing. And the one thing is symbolized by the Ouroboros, by the way, as we saw earlier. Then it says, "And just as all things have come from this one thing, through the meditation of the one mind, so do all things created originate from this one thing through transformation." So yeah, it's all about alchemy, basically. So, and Mercury, of course, is the god of alchemy. So is Eros. So you have here's the images I generated from a AI program called Starry AI. They're of Hermes Trismegistus, of course. So I thought the AI did a really good job with that one. And I put that in the book, so it looks pretty cool to me. Now, this doesn't really connect to what we discussed earlier, but it is in the book. And I talked about in depth in the book how there is a deity called Sabazeus. And he's basically a mixture of Dionysus and Zeus, if I remember correctly. But it just so happens he does the same pose as St. Peter. And St. Peter can be equated with Janus. And Janus is a very Mithraic deity. He's the ones that holds the keys to heaven, right? So he has two faces that go opposite ways, right? Now, in the book, so I get into this essay that I found online. It's by Ernest Martin, if I remember correctly. So he wrote an essay called Simon and His Universal Church. And what's so crazy about the whole essay is that he actually thinks that Simon the Magician actually created the Roman Catholic Church. So I thought that was really interesting. And I get into that in the book. So I sort of investigate that, what it all means, and how it all connects to a lot of these these paganism that I actually looked into. So, and then of course you have the Vaticanus is the Latin word for Vatus, which means prophet or soothsayer. So there's a lot of alchemical symbolism going on in the Roman Catholic Church for sure. Now, I mean, I'm not, I mean, I don't hate on snakes. I mean, but I know it is, of course, associated with the devil and all that jazz. But of, you know, the serpent is a very Orphic alchemical symbol, as we just saw earlier. And of course, with Sophia as well. And of course, you know, also with, you know, the rising serpent from the book of John, where Jesus himself equates himself to. Then here's a Thracian version of Sabazeus, the horseman, so connects to a St. George. And I talk about that in the book as well. He, of course, connects to St. Michael. Then you have Cybele and Attis. They're both fringing gods. And the Roman Catholic Church definitely modeled a lot of their stuff from the Roman remnants of their previous pagan incarnation, you know? So that's where a lot, even like the ideas of like, you know, the Virgin Mary sort of like have a basis with like a Cybele for sure. And Cybele, I think the priests of Cybele were said to be eunuchs. So they're like eunuchs for God or eunuchs for the goddess, you know? I mean, even Jesus in Matthew says like, you know, it's good to be a eunuch, you know? Or at least the Jesus in that gospel, that is. And there's Attis holding a hook, right? Then there's Michael. Saint Michael was on the left. He's weighing the soul, along with the devil. And then you have the Egyptian Anubis. So, I mean, I guess the point of me looking at all that, all the stuff, I mean, I'm just pointing out all these different overlaps. I mean, are they all the same deities? I mean, maybe. But, I mean, they definitely have, like, different overlapping correspondences, yeah. Then you have another Ion. You have St. Michael as the mercurial psychopomp thing over the dead soul. I said deal soul should be dead. let's see. Then there's the Archangel Michael defeating Satan by Guido Reni. Then you have another image I found of St. Michael from a different website. It's called, I forgot where I got it, but I thought that was really good. Really good image here. Then you have another image from the Apocalypse that I found is pretty interesting. So it connects to my previous book, The Sun Lady Unveiled. And if you haven't read that book, it's pretty thick unveiling of what it all means in the Book of Revelation, especially in the Book of Revelation chapter 12. Let's see. Then there's like an image from John Stekinski, for the mediations of the visions of John, the image of the angels throwing down Satan from heaven, right? Then you have an image that I generated from Starry AI again. It's the Sun Lady Unveiled. And she looks pretty hot. I thought it was pretty interesting how an AI would devise something so just, you know, so much depth. It's like, it's so crazy. Then you have my book here. It's still out on Amazon. And you can purchase that also from lulu.com. So the artwork is from Jesse Pepper. He's a brilliant artist. And here are my social media plugs if you want to follow my stuff. And that's about it, really. Do I have any questions at all?
No, that was amazing. Thank you, Alex. Let me get myself back here. Power is back on at the house, but I'm still on the phone. I don't want to switch. I'm too paranoid about the recording. But yeah, no, this is amazing. This is what I live for, and it's this is very important, as I've said, because as you and I have talked, this is knowledge we need, because the elite know about these gods and they're still worshiping these gods behind the scenes, this Mithras and Aeon and all this stuff, these demiurges, because they know they have power. So it's important to know this stuff, this trajectory and this vibe and these rituals and all that. So your work is extremely important because it, again, it lifts the veil on things. But I want to let, if anybody else has any questions, you can stop the screen share if you want, and we can take some questions beyond me.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.